Sleepy faces greeted me at every turn in the winding lanes, smiling and offering the blessings of the morning in six languages and as many different faiths. I entered my hut and looked with new fondness at the humble, comfortable shabbiness of it. It was good to be home. I cleaned up the mess in my hut and then joined the morning procession of men who filed out onto the concrete pier that we used as a latrine. When I returned, I discovered that my neighbours had prepared two full buckets of hot water for my bath. I rarely bothered with the laborious and time-consuming procedure of heating several pots of water on the kerosene stove, preferring the lazier, if less luxurious, option of a cold water bath. Knowing that, my neighbours sometimes provided it for me. It was no small service. Water, the most precious commodity in any slum, had to be carried from the communal well in the legal compound, some 300 metres away beyond the barbed wire. Because the well was only open twice a day, there were hundreds of people in the shove and wrestle for water, and each bucket was dragged into the light with bluff and scratch and shout. Carried back and hoisted through the wire, the water had to be boiled in saucepans on small kerosene stoves, at some cost of the relatively expensive fuel. Yet when they did that for me, none of my neighbours ever took credit for it or expected thanks. The water I used might have been boiled and brought there by Amir's family as a sign of appreciation for the treatment I'd given him. It might have come from my nearest neighbour, or it might have been provided by one of the half dozen people who stood around and watched me bathe. I would never know. It was one of those small, uncelebrated things people did for me every week. In a sense, the ghetto existed on a foundation of those anonymous, unthankable deeds. Insignificant and almost trivial in themselves, but collectively essential to the survival of the slum. We soothed our neighbours' children as if they were our own when they cried. We tightened a loose rope on someone else's hut when we noticed it sagging, and adjusted the lay of a plastic roof as we passed by. We helped one another without being asked, as if we were all members of one huge tribe or family, and the thousand huts were simply rooms in our mansion home. At his invitation, I breakfasted with Kasim Ali Hussein. We drank sweet tea spiced with clove and ate waffle-style rotis filled with ghee and sugar and rolled into tubes. Ranjit's lepers had delivered a new batch of medicines and bandages on the previous day. Because I was away all afternoon, they'd left the bundles with Kasim Ali. We sorted through them together. Kasim Ali couldn't read or write English, and he insisted that I explain the contents and uses of the various capsules, tablets, and salves that I'd ordered. One of his sons, Ayub, sat with us, and wrote the name and description of each medicine in the Urdu script on tiny fragments of paper, and patiently attached a label to every container or tube of cream with adhesive tape. I didn't know it then, but Kasim Ali had chosen Ayub to be my assistant, to learn everything possible about medicines and their uses, so that he could replace me when the time came, as the headman was sure that it would, for me to leave the slum. It was 11 o'clock when I finally found time to stop at Carla's small house near the Colaba market. There was no answer to my knocking. Her neighbours told me she'd gone out an hour earlier. They had no idea when she would return. I was annoyed. I'd left my boots and jeans inside, and I was anxious to retrieve them, to get out of those loose but uncomfortable clothes, those clothes that were hers. I hadn't exaggerated when I'd told her that the jeans, T-shirt and boots were my only clothes. In my hut there were only two lungis, which I wore for sleeping, bathing, or for when I washed my jeans. I could have bought new clothes. A T-shirt, jeans and track shoes would have cost me no more than $4 or $5 American in the clothing bazaar at Fashion Street. But I wanted my own clothes, the clothes I felt right in. I left a grumble of words for her in a note and set off to keep my appointment with Kader Bai. The great house on Muhammad Ali Road seemed to be empty when I arrived. The six panels of the street door were folded back, and the spacious marble entrance hall was exposed. Thousands of people walked past every hour, but the house was well known, and no one on the street seemed to pay any attention to me as I entered. knocking on the green panels to announce my arrival. After a few moments, Nazir came to greet me, his frown vaguely hostile. He directed me to swap my street shoes for a pair of house slippers, and then led me along a tall, narrow corridor in the opposite direction to that of the room I'd visited the night before. We passed a number of closed rooms as the corridor wound through two right turns, and eventually came out upon an inner courtyard. The very large oval space was open to the sky in the centre, as if a great hole had been cut in the thick plasterwork of the ceiling. It was paved with heavy, square Maharashtrian stone, and surrounded by pillared arches that gave a cloister effect. There were many plants and flowering shrubs in the wide circle of the interior garden, and five tall, slender palms. The fountain that I'd heard from the meeting room, where we'd talked about suffering, was the centrepiece. It was a circle of marble about a metre in height and 4 metres in diameter, with a single huge uncut boulder in the centre. Water seemed to sprout from the very core of the enormous stone. At its peak, the small fountain curved into a lily-shaped plume before splashing gently onto the smooth, rounded surfaces of the boulder and flowing with rhythmic, musical flourishes into the pond of the fountain. Kadarbai was sitting in a cane emperor chair to one side of the fountain. He was reading a book, which he closed and placed on a glass-topped table when I arrived.
"Salam alaikum, Mr. Lin," he replied.
"Peace be with you."
"Wa alaikum salam.
Ap kaiser hai." "And with you be peace. How are you, sir?"
"I am well, thank you. Mad dogs and Englishmen may very well be out and about in the midday sun, but I prefer to sit here, in the shade of my humble garden."
"Not so humble, Kadarbai," I remarked.
"Do you think it's altogether too grand?"
"No, no, I didn't mean that," I said hurriedly, because that's precisely what I'd been thinking. I couldn't help but recall that he owned the slum where I lived. The dusty, barren slum of 25,000 people, where nothing green existed after 8 rainless months, and the only water was rationed from wells that were padlocked shut most of the time. "This is the most beautiful place I've ever seen in Bombay. I couldn't have imagined this from the street outside." He stared at me for a few moments as if measuring the exact width and depth of the lie, and then waved me to a small, backless stool that was the only other chair in the courtyard.
"Please sit down, Mr. Lin. Have you eaten?"
"Yes, thank you. I had a late breakfast."
"Allow me to serve you tea, at least."
"Nazir! Idar au!"
he shouted, his voice startling a pair of doves that had been pecking for crumbs at his feet. The birds flew up and flapped around Nazir's chest as he entered. They seemed to be unafraid of him, even to recognize him, and they settled on the flagstones once more, following him like tame puppies.
"Chai bono, Nazir,"
Kadarbai commanded. His tone with the driver was imperious, but not severe, and I guessed that it was the only tone Nazir felt comfortable with and respected. The burly Afghan withdrew silently, the birds hop-running behind him into the very house. "Kadarbai, there's something I want to say before we talk about anything else," I began quietly. My next words drew his head up swiftly, and I knew that I had his full attention. "It's about Chapna."
"Yes, go on," he murmured.
"Well, I thought about it a lot last night, what we were talking about, and what you asked me to do at the meeting to sort of help you and so on. And I've got a problem with it." He smiled and raised one eyebrow quizzically, but he said nothing more, and I was forced to explain myself further. "I know I'm not saying this very well, but I just don't feel right about it. No matter what this guy did, I don't want to be put in a position of being, well, a kind of cop. I wouldn't feel right about working with them, even indirectly. In my country, the phrase, helping the police with their inquiries, is a euphemism for informing on someone. I'm sorry. I understand that this guy killed people. If you want to go after him, that's your business. And I'm happy to help you out in any way I can. But I don't want to be involved with the cops, or to help them do it. If you're working outside the law, on your own, if you want to go after him and put him out of action personally, for whatever reason of your own, then I'll be glad to help. You can count me in if you want to fight his gang, whoever they are.
Is there anything more?
No, that's pretty much it.
Very well, Mr. Lin, he replied.
His face was impassive as he studied me, but there was a puzzling laughter in his eyes.
I may put your mind at rest, I think, in assuring you that while I do assist a large number of policemen financially, so to say, I do not ever work with them. I can tell you, however, that the matter of Shapna is a deeply personal one. And I would ask that if you should wish to confide anything at all about this terrible fellow, you will speak of it only to me. You will not speak to any of the gentlemen you met here last night about this Shapna, or to anyone else. Is that agreed?
Yes, that's agreed.
Was there anything else?
Well, no.
Excellent. Then to business. I have very little time today, Mr. Lin, so I will come directly to the point of the matter. The favor that I mentioned yesterday. I want you to teach one small boy named Tariq the English language. Not everything, of course, but enough that his English will be considerably improved, and that he will have some little advantage when he begins his formal studies.
Well, I'll be happy to try, I stammered, bewildered by the request, but not daunted by it. I felt competent to teach the fundamentals of the language that I wrote in every day of my life. I don't know how good I'll be at it. I think there must be a lot of people who'd be better than I would, but I'm happy to take a shot at it. Where do you want me to do it? Would I come here to teach him? He looked at me with benign, almost affectionate condescension.
Why, he will stay with you, naturally. I want you to have him with you, constantly, for the next 10 or 12 weeks. He will live with you, eat with you, sleep at your house, go where you go. I do not simply want that he learns the English phrases. I want that he learns the English way, your way. I want that he learns this with your constant company.
But I'm not English, I objected stupidly.
This is no matter. You are English enough, don't you think? You are a foreigner, and you will teach him the ways of a foreigner. It is my desire.
My mind was hot, my thoughts scattered and flapping like the birds that he'd startled with his voice. There had to be a way out. It was impossible. But I live at the Jopadpati, you know that. It's very rough. My hut is really small and there's nothing in it. He'll be uncomfortable. And it's dirty and crowded and where would he sleep and all that?
I am aware of your situation, Mr. Lin, he replied, a little sharply. It is precisely this, your life in the Jopadpati, that I want him to know. Tell me your honest opinion. Do you think that there are lessons to be learned in the slum? Do you think he will benefit from spending some time with the city's poorest people?
I did think that, of course. It seemed to me that every child, beginning with the sons and daughters of the rich, would benefit from the experience of slum life. Yes, I suppose I do. I do think it's important to see how people live there. But you have to understand it's a huge responsibility for me. I'm not doing a spectacular job of looking after myself. I don't know how I could look after a kid. Nazir arrived with the tea and a prepared chillum.
Ah, here is our tea. We shall first smoke, yes?
We first smoked. Nazir squatted on his haunches to smoke with us. As Kadirbai puffed on the clay funnel, Nazir gave me a complex series of nods, frowns and winks that seem to say, "Look, see how the master smokes. See what a great lord he is. See how much he is that you and I will never be. See how lucky we are to be here with him." Nazir was a head shorter than I was, but I guessed that he was at least several kilos heavier. His neck was so thick that it seemed to draw his powerful shoulders up towards his ears. The bulky arms that stretched the seams of his loose shirt appeared to be only slightly more slender than his thighs. His broad, permanently scowling face was composed of three downward curves, something like the insignia of sergeant's stripes. The first of them consisted of his eyebrows, which began a little above and in the centre of his eyes, and descended with bristling unruliness along the slope of his frown to the level of the eyes themselves. The second curve began in the deep grooves at the wings of his nose, and divided his face all the way to the jaw. The third was drawn by the desperate, pugnacious unhappiness of his mouth, the upside-down horseshoe of bad luck that fate had nailed to the doorpost of his life. A ridge of purplish scar tissue was prominent on the brown skin of his forehead. His dark eyes moved in their deep hollows like hunted things, constantly seeking concealment. His ears looked as though they'd been chewed by some beast that had blunted its teeth on them and given up the task. His most striking feature was his nose, an instrument so huge and magnificently pendulous that it seemed designed for some purpose altogether more grand than merely inhaling air and fragrances. I thought him ugly then, when I first knew him, not so much for the unbeautiful set of his features as for their joylessness. It seemed to me that I'd never seen a human face in which the smile had been so utterly defeated. The chillum returned to me for the third time, but the smoke was hot and tasted foul. I announced that it was finished. Nazir seized it from me roughly and puffed with furious determination, managing to extract a dirty brown cloud of smoke. He tapped the gitak stone out onto his palm to reveal a tiny residue of white ash. Making sure that I was watching, he blew the ash from his hand to the ground at my feet, cleared his throat menacingly, and then left us. "Nazir doesn't like me very much." Kadarbai laughed. It was a sudden and very youthful laugh. I liked it, and I was moved to join him, though I didn't really understand why he was laughing.
"Do you like Nazir?"
he asked, still laughing. "No, I guess I don't," I answered, and we laughed all the harder.
"You do not want to teach Tariq English because you do not want the responsibility," he said, when the laughter had subsided.
"It's not just that. Well, yes, it is just that. It's..." I looked into those golden eyes, pleading with them. "I'm not very good with responsibility. And this is a lot of responsibility. It's too much. I can't do it."
He smiled and reached out to rest his hand on my forearm.
"I understand. You are worried. It is natural. You are worried that something might happen to Tariq. You are worried that you will lose your freedom to go where you want and do what you want. This is only natural."
"Yes," I murmured, relieved. He did understand. He knew that I couldn't do what he asked. He was going to let me off the hook. Sitting there, on the low stool beside his chair, I had to look up at him, and I felt at some disadvantage. I also felt a sudden rush of affection for him, an affection that seemed to proceed from and depend upon the inequalities between us. It was vassal love, one of the strongest and most mysterious human emotions.
"Very well. My decision is this, Lin. You will take Tariq with you and have him remain with you for 2 days. If, after this 48 hours, you think it is impossible for the situation to continue, you will bring him back here, and I will ask no more of you. But I am sure that he will be no problem to you. My nephew is a fine boy."
"Your nephew?
Yes, the fourth son of my youngest sister, Farishta. He is 11 years old. He has learned some English words, and he speaks Hindi, Pashto, Urdu, and Marathi fluently. He is not so tall for his age, but he is most sturdy in his health.
Your nephew, I began again, but he cut me off quickly.
If you find that you can do this thing for me, you will see that my dear friend in the Jhopadpati, Kasim Ali Hussein, you know him, of course, as the head man, he will help you in every way. He will arrange for some families, including his own, to share your responsibility and provide homes for the boy to sleep in as well as your own. There will be many friends to help you look after Tariq. I want him to know the hardest life of the poorest people. But above all, I want him to have the experience of an English teacher. This last thing means a great deal to me. When I was a boy...
He paused, allowing his gaze to shift and settle on the fountain and the wet surface of the great round boulder. His eyes gleamed, reflecting the liquid light on the stone. Then a grave expression passed across them, like a cloud shadow slinking over smooth hills on a sunny day.
So, 48 hours,
he sighed, bringing himself to the moment.
After that, if you bring him back to me, I will not think the worse of you. Now, it is time for you to meet the boy.
Kadarbai gestured towards the arches of the cloister behind me, and I turned to see that the boy was already standing there. He was small for his age. Kadarbai had said that he was 11 years old, but he seemed to be no more than 8. Dressed in clean, pressed kurta pyjama and leather sandals, he clutched a tied calico bundle in his arms. He stared at me with such a forlorn and distrustful expression that I thought he might burst into tears. Kadarbai called him forward, and the boy approached us, making a wide detour around me to the far side of his uncle's chair. The closer he came, the more miserable he seemed. Kadarbai spoke to him sternly and swiftly in Urdu, pointing at me several times. When he finished, the boy walked to my stool and extended his hand to me.
"Hello very much,"
he said, his eyes huge with reluctance and fear. I shook hands with him, his small hand vanishing in mine. Nothing ever fits the palm so perfectly, or feels so right, or inspires so much protective instinct as the hand of a child. "Hello to you too, Tariq," I said, smiling in spite of myself. His eyes flickered a tiny hopeful smile in response, but doubt quickly smothered it. He looked back to his uncle. It was a look of desperate unhappiness, drawing his closed mouth wide and pulling his small nose in so tightly that it showed white at the corners. Kadarbai returned the look, staring strength into the boy, then stood up and called for Nazir once more in that half-shout.
"You will forgive me, Mr. Lin. There are a number of matters that require my urgent attentions. I will expect you in 2 days if you are not happy, nah? Nazir will show you out."
He turned without looking at the boy and strode off into the shadowed arches. Tariq and I watched him leave, each of us feeling abandoned and betrayed. Nazir walked with us to the door. As I changed into my street shoes, Nazir knelt and pressed the boy to his chest with surprising and passionate tenderness. Tariq clung to him, grabbing his hair, and had to be prized from the embrace with some force. When we stood once more, Nazir gave me a look of eloquent, lingering menace. "If anything happens to this boy, you will answer to me for it," and turned away from us. A minute later, we were outside, on the street beside the Nabila Mosque. Boy and man joined tightly at the hand, but in nothing else except our bewilderment at the power of the personality that had pushed us together against our wills. Tariq had simply been obedient, but there was something craven in my helplessness to resist Kadarbai. I'd capitulated too readily, and I knew it. Self-disgust quickly became self-righteousness. How could he do this to a child? I asked myself. His own nephew. Give him up so easily to a stranger. Didn't he see how reluctant the boy was? It's a callous disregard for the rights and well-being of a child. Only a man who thought of others as his playthings would surrender a child to someone like me. Furious at my feeble pliancy, how did I let him force me to do this? And burning with spite and selfishness, I dragged Tariq along at a jogging trot as I marched through the swarming street. Just as we passed the main entrance to the mosque, the muezzin began to recite the call to prayer from the minarets above our heads.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, ashhadu an la ilaha illallah.
God is great, God is great. I bear witness that there is no God but God. Tariq tugged at my wrists with both hands, pulling me to a stop. He pointed at the entrance to the mosque, and then to the tower above it, where loudspeakers amplified the voice of the muezzin. I shook my head and told him we had no time. He planted his feet and tugged harder at my wrist. I told him, in Hindi and Marathi, that I wasn't a Muslim, and I didn't want to enter the mosque. He was adamant, straining to drag me toward the doorway until the veins stood out at his temples. At last he broke free from my grip and scampered up the steps of the mosque. Kicking his sandals aside, he darted inside before I could stop him. Frustrated and wavering, I hesitated at the large open archway of the mosque. I knew that it was permitted for non-believers to enter. People of any faith may enter any mosque and pray, or meditate, or simply admire and wonder. But I knew that the Muslims regarded themselves as a minority under siege in the predominantly Hindu city. Violent confrontations between religionists were common enough. Prabhakar warned me once that clashes had occurred between militant Hindus and Muslims outside that very mosque. I had no idea what to do. I was certain there were other exits, and if the boy decided to run off, there would be little chance of finding him. A throbbing dread drummed in my heart at the thought that I might have to return to Kadarbai and tell him I'd lost his nephew, not 100 meters from where he'd entrusted the boy to me. Just as I made up my mind to go inside and search the mosque, Tariq came into view, passing from right to left across the huge, ornately tiled vestibule. His hands, feet, and head were wet, and it seemed that he'd washed himself hurriedly. Leaning as far into the entrance as I dared, I saw the boy take up a position at the rear of a group of men and begin his prayers. I sat down on an empty pushcart and smoked a cigarette. To my great relief, Tariq emerged after a few minutes, collected his sandals, and came over to join me. Standing very close to me, he looked up into my face and gave me a smile frown, one of those splendidly contradictory expressions that only children seem to master, as if he were afraid and happy at the same time.
"Zuhr! Zuhr!"
he said, indicating that it was the time of the noon prayer. His voice was remarkably firm for such a small child.
"I am thank you for God. Are you thank you for God, Lean Baba?"
I knelt on one knee in front of him and seized his arms. He winced, but I didn't relax the grip. My eyes were angry. I knew that my face looked hard and perhaps even cruel.
"Don't you ever do that again," I snapped at him in Hindi. "Don't you ever run away from me again."
He frowned at me, defiant and afraid. Then his young face hardened into the mask we used to fight back tears. I saw his eyes fill, and one tear escaped to roll down his flushed cheek. I stood and took a step away from him. Glancing around me, I saw that a few men and women had stopped on the street to stare at us. Their expressions were grave, although not yet alarmed. I reached out to offer the boy an open palm. He put his hand in mine, reluctantly, and I struck out along the street, toward the nearest taxi stand. I turned once to look over my shoulder, and saw that the people were following us with their eyes. My heart was beating fast. A viscid mix of emotions boiled in me, but I knew that most of it was rage, and most of the anger was at myself. I stopped, and the boy stopped with me. I breathed deeply for a few moments, fighting for reasonable control. When I looked down at him, Tariq was staring at me intently, with his head cocked to one side. "I'm sorry I got angry with you, Tariq," I said calmly, repeating the words in Hindi. "I won't do it again, but please, please don't run away from me like that. It makes me very scared and worried." The boy grinned at me. It was the first real smile he gave me. I was startled to see that it was very similar to Prabhakar's lunar disc of a smile. "Oh, God help me," I said, sighing all the way from the core of my bones. "Not another one."
"Yes, okay, very much,"
Tariq agreed, shaking my hand with gymnastic enthusiasm.
"God help you and me all day, please."
Chapter 16. When will she be back? How should I know? Not long, maybe. She said to wait. I don't know. It's getting late. I've got to get this kid home to bed. Whatever. It's all the same to me, Jack. She said to wait, that's all. I glanced at Tariq. He didn't look tired, but I knew he had to be getting sleepy. I decided that a rest was a good idea before the walk home. We kicked off our shoes and entered Carla's house, closing the street door behind us. I found some chilled water in the large, old-fashioned refrigerator. Tariq accepted a glass and sat down on a pile of cushions to flip through a copy of India Today magazine. Lisa was in Carla's bedroom, sitting on the bed with her knees drawn up. She was wearing a red silk pajama jacket and nothing else. A patch of her blonde pubic hair was visible, and I glimpsed reflexively over my shoulder to make sure that the boy couldn't see into the room. She cradled a bottle of Jack Daniels in her folded arms. Her long curly hair was tied up into a lopsided bun. She was staring at me with an expression of calculated appraisal, one eye almost closed. It reminded me of the look that marksmen concentrate on their targets in a firing range. "So where'd you get the kid?" I sat on a straight-backed chair, straddling it, so that my forearms could rest on the back. "I sort of inherited him. I'm doing someone a favor." "A favor?" she asked, as if the word was a euphemism for some kind of infection. "Yeah, a friend of mine asked me to teach the kid a little English." "So what's he doing here? Why isn't he at home?" "I'm supposed to keep him with me. That's how he's supposed to learn."
"You mean keep him with you all the time? Everywhere you go?"
"That's the deal. But I'm hoping to give him back after 2 days. I don't know how I got talked into it in the first place, really." She laughed out loud. It wasn't a pleasant sound. The state she was in gave it a forced and almost vicious edge. Still, the heart of it was rich and full, and I thought it might have been a nice laugh once. She took a swig from the bottle, exposing one round breast with the movement.
"I don't like kids," she said proudly, as if she was announcing that she'd just received some distinguished award.
She took another long drink. The bottle was half full. I realized that she was early drunk, in that squall of coherence before slurred speech and clumsiness and collapse. "Look, I just want to get my clothes," I muttered, looking around the bedroom for them. "I'll pick them up and come back and see Carla another time."
"I'll make you a deal, Gilbert."
"The name's Lynn," I insisted, although that too was a false name.
"I'll make you a deal, Lynn. I'll tell you where your clothes are if you agree to put them on here in front of me."
We didn't like each other. We stared across the kind of bristling hostility that's sometimes as good as or better than mutual attraction. "Assuming you can handle it," I drawled, grinning in spite of myself. What's in it for me? She laughed again, and it was stronger and more honest.
You're all right, Lynn. Get me some water, will you? The more of this stuff I drink, the goddamn thirstier I get.
On my way to the small kitchen, I checked on Tariq. The boy had fallen asleep. His head was tipped back onto the cushions, and his mouth was open. One hand was curled up under his chin, and the other still grasped weakly at the magazine. I removed it and covered him with a light woolen shawl that was hanging from a set of hooks. He didn't stir and seemed to be deep in sleep. In the kitchen, I took a bottle of chilled water from the refrigerator, snatched up two tumblers, and returned to the bedroom. The kid's asleep, I said, handing her a glass. I'll let him crash for a while. If he doesn't wake up by himself, I'll get him up later.
Sit here,
she commanded, patting at the bed beside her. I sat. She watched me over the rim of her glass as I drank first one, then a second full glass of the iced water.
The water's good, she said after a while. Have you noticed that the water's good here? I mean, really good. You'd expect it to be fucking slime, I mean, being Bombay and India and all. People are so scared of the water, but it's really much better than the chemical-tasting horse piss that comes out of the faucet back home.
Where is home?
What the fuck difference does it make?
She watched me frown impatiently and added quickly,
Don't get mad, keep your goddamn shirt on. I'm not trying to be a smartass. I really mean it. What difference does it make? I'll never go back there, and you'll never go there in the first place.
I guess not.
God, it's hot. I hate this time of the year. It's always worst just before the monsoon. It makes me crazy. Doesn't this weather make you crazy? This is my fourth monsoon. You start to count in monsoons after you've been here a while. Didier is a 9-monsoon guy. Can you believe that? 9 fucking monsoons in Bombay. How about you?
This is my second. I'm looking forward to it. I love the rain, even if it does turn the slum into a swamp.
Carla told me you live in one of the slums. I don't know how you can stand it. That stink. All those people living on top of each other. You'd never get me inside one of those places.
Like most things, and most people, it's not as bad as it looks from the outside. She let her head fall onto one shoulder and looked at me. I couldn't read her expression. Her eyes glittered in a radiant, almost inviting smile, but her mouth was twisted in a disdainful sneer.
You're a real funny guy, Lynn. How did you really get hooked up with that kid?
I told you.
So what's he like?
I thought you didn't like kids.
I don't. They're so innocent. Except that they're not. They know exactly what they want, and they don't stop till they get it. It's disgusting. All the worst people I know are just like big grown-up children. It's so creepy it makes me sick to my stomach.
Children might have turned her stomach, but it seemed to be immune to the searing effects of the sour mash whiskey. She tipped the bottle back and drank off a good quarter of it in long, slow swallows. That's the one, I thought. If she wasn't drunk before, she is now. She wiped her lips with the back of her hand and smiled, but the expression was lopsided, and the focus was spilling from the bowls of her china blue eyes. Falling and fading as she was, the mask of her many abrasive attitudes began to slip, and she suddenly looked very young and vulnerable. The set of her jaw, angry, fearing, and dislikable, relaxed into an expression that was surprisingly gentle and compassionate. Her cheeks were round and pink. The tip of her nose was turned up slightly and formed in soft contours. She was a 24-year-old woman with the face of a girl, unmarked by the hollows of compromise or the deeply drawn lines of hard decisions. From the few things that Carla had told me about her, and what I'd seen at Madame Jo's, her life had in fact been harder than most, but none of that showed in her face. She offered me the bottle, and I accepted it, taking a sip. I held on to it for a few moments, and when she wasn't looking, I placed it on the floor beside the bed, discreetly out of her reach. She lit a cigarette and messed at her hair, spilling the loosely tied bun until the long curls fell over one shoulder. With her hand poised there, on top of her head, the wide sleeve of her silk jacket slipped past her elbow and exposed the pale stubble of a shaved armpit. There was no sign of other drugs in the room, but her pupils were contracted to pinpoints, suggesting that she'd taken heroin or some other opiate. Whatever the combination, it was sending her swiftly over the edge. She was slumped uncomfortably against the bedstead, and she was breathing noisily through her mouth. A little trickle of whiskey and saliva dribbled from the corner of her slack lower lip. Still, she was beautiful. The thought struck me that she would always look beautiful, even when she was being ugly. Hers was a big, lovely, empty face. The face of a pom-pom girl at a football match. The face advertisers use to help them sell preposterous and irrelevant things.
So go on, tell me. What's he like, that little kid?
Well, I think he's some kind of religious fanatic, I confided, smiling, as I looked over my shoulder at the sleeping boy. He made me stop 3 times today and this evening so he could say his prayers. I don't know if it's doing his soul any good, but his stomach seems to be working fine. He can eat like they're giving prizes for it. He kept me in the restaurant for more than 2 hours tonight, eating everything from noodles and grilled fish to ice cream and jelly. That's why we're late. I would have been home ages ago, but I couldn't get him out of the restaurant. It's going to cost me an arm and a leg to keep him for the next couple of days. He eats more than I do.
Do you know how Hannibal died? She asked.
Come again?
Hannibal, that guy with the elephant. Don't you know your history? He crossed the Alps with his elephants to attack the Romans.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about, I said testily, irritated by the conversational non sequitur.
Well, how did he die? She demanded.
Her expressions were becoming exaggerated, the gross burlesque of the drunk. I don't know.
Ha! She scoffed. You don't know everything.
No, I don't know everything. There was a lengthening silence. She stared at me blankly. It seemed that I could see the thoughts drifting downwards through the blue of her eyes, like white flakes in the bubble of a snow dome. So are you going to tell me? I probed after a while. How did he die?
Who'd I?
She asked, mystified. Hannibal, you were going to tell me how he died.
Oh, him. Well, he kind of led this army of 30,000 guys over the Alps into Italy and fought the Romans for like 16 years. 16 goddamn years. And he never got beaten, even one time. Then, after a lot of other shit, he went back to his own country, where he became a big honcho, what with being a big hero and all. But the Romans, those guys never forgot that he embarrassed the fuck out of them, so they used politics, and they got his own people to turn on him and kick him out. Are you getting any of this?
Sure.
I mean, really, am I wasting my goddamn time here with this? I don't have to do this, you know. I can spend my time with a lot better people than you. I can be with anyone I like. Anyone.
The forgotten cigarette was burning down to her fingers. I placed the ashtray under it and prized it loose, letting it fall from her hand into the bowl. She didn't seem to notice. Okay, so the Romans forced Hannibal's own people to kick him out, I pressed, actually curious about the fate of the Carthaginian warrior.
They exiled him, she corrected grumpily.
Exiled him. Then what happened? How did he die?
Lisa stirred her head from the pillows suddenly, her movements groggy, and glared at me with what seemed to be real malevolence.
What's so special about Carla, huh?
she demanded furiously.
I'm more beautiful than she is. Take a good look. My tits are better than hers.
She pulled the silk jacket open until she was quite naked, touching at her breasts clumsily.
Well, aren't they?
They're very nice, I muttered.
Nice? They're goddamn beautiful is what they are. They're perfect. You want to touch them, don't you? Here.
She snatched at my wrist with surprising speed and dragged my hand onto her thigh near the hip. The flesh was warm and smooth and supple. Nothing in the world is so soft and pleasing to the touch as the skin of a woman's thigh. No flower, feather, or fabric can match that velvet whisper of flesh. No matter how unequal they may be in other ways, all women, old and young, fat and thin, beautiful and ugly, have that perfection. It's a great part of the reason why men hunger to possess women, and so often convince themselves that they do possess them. The thigh, that touch.
Has Carla told you what I did at the palace, huh? What I used to do there?
She said with puzzling hostility, moving my hand onto the hard little mound of blonde hair between her legs.
Madame Jo has us play games there. They're big on games at the palace. Carla told you about those games, did she? Huh? Blind man's butt, did she tell you about that? The customers wear blindfolds and get a prize for guessing which one of us they push their cock into. No hands, you see. That's the trick. Did she tell you any of this? Did she tell you about the chair? That's a real popular number. One girl kneels down on her hands and knees, see? Then another girl lies on top of her back to back and they tie them together. The customers go from one to the other, kind of multiple choice. Is this turning you on, Lynn? Are you getting hot with this? Used to turn Carla's customers on when she brought them to the palace. Carla has a business head. Did you know that? I worked at the palace, but it was just a job, and all I ever made out of it was money. She's the one who made it dirty. She's the one who made it a sick thing. Carla's the one who'll do anything to get what she wants. Damn right. A business head and her heart to match.
She was rubbing my hand against herself with both of her own hands, grinding against it with rolling motions of her hips. She drew up her knees and her legs parted. My hand was drawn to the lips of her vagina, heavy and swollen and wet. She pushed two of my fingers inside the dark heat.
You feel that?
She mumbled, her teeth clenched and exposed in a grim smile.
That's muscle power, boy. That's what that is. That's training and practice, hours of it, months of it. Madame Jo makes us squat and squeeze down hard on a pencil to build up a grip like a fist. I got so fucking good at it I could write a letter with a goddamn thing. You feel how good that is? You'll never find anything as tight as this. Not anywhere. Carla isn't this good. I know she isn't. What's the matter with you? Don't you want to fuck me? What are you, some kind of faggot?
She was still squeezing down on my fingers, still grasping at my wrist, but the straining smile faded, and her face slowly turned away.
I think I'm gonna throw up.
I withdrew my fingers from her body and my hand from her weakening grip and backed away from the bed towards the bathroom. Hurriedly soaking a towel in cold water and grabbing up a large dish from the bathroom, I returned to find her sprawled out awkwardly, her hands on her belly. I straightened her into a more comfortable position, covering her with a light cotton blanket. I draped the cool towel over her forehead. She stirred a little, but she didn't resist. Her frown gradually dissolved into the earnest mask of the unwell.
He committed suicide,
she said softly, her eyes closed.
That Hannibal. They were going to extradite him back to Rome, make him face charges at a trial, so he killed himself. How do you like that? After all that fighting, all those elephants, all those big battles, he killed himself. It's true. Carla told me. Carla always tells the truth, even when she's lying. She said that to me once. I always tell the truth, even when I'm lying. Fuck, I love that girl. I love that girl. You know, she saved me from that place. And you did, too. And she's helping me to get clean. To dry out. Gotta dry out, Lynn. Gilbert. Gotta get off the shit. I love that girl.
She slept. I watched her for a while, waiting to see if she was sick, if she would wake. But she was wrapped in unworried sleep. I went to check on Tariq, and he too was sleeping soundly. I decided not to wake him. Being alone in that stillness was a piercing pleasure. Wealth and power, in a city where half the many millions were homeless, were measured by the privacy that only money could buy, and the solitude that only power could demand and enforce. The poor were almost never alone in Bombay, and I was poor. There, in that breathing room, no sound reached me from the quieting street. I moved through the apartment freely, unwatched, and the silence was sweeter, it seemed, the peace more profound for the presence of the two sleepers, woman and child. A balm of fantasy soothed me. There was a time, once, when I'd known such a life, when a woman and a sleeping child were my own, and I was their man. I stopped at Carla's cluttered writing desk and caught sight of myself in a wide mirror on the wall above it. The momentary fantasy of belonging, that little dream of home and family, hardened and cracked in my eyes. The truth was that my own marriage had crumbled to ruin, and I'd lost my child, my daughter. The truth was that Lisa and Tariq meant nothing to me, and I meant nothing to them. The truth was that I belonged nowhere and to no one. Surrounded by people and hungry for solitude, I was always and everywhere alone. Worse than that, I was hollow, empty, gouged out and scraped bare by the escape and flight. I'd lost my family, the friends of my youth, my country and its culture. All the things that had defined me and given me identity. Like all the fugitive kind, the more successful I was, the longer and further I ran, the less I kept of myself. But there were people, a few, who could reach me, a few new friends for the new self I was learning to become. There was Prabhakar, that tiny, life-adoring man. There was Johnny Sagar and Kasim Ali, and Jitendra and his wife, Radha. Heroes of chaos, who propped up the collapsible city with bamboo sticks and insisted on loving their neighbours, no matter how far they'd fallen, no matter how broken or unlovely they were. There was Kader Bhai, there was Abdullah, there was Didier, and there was Carla. And as I looked into my own hard eyes in the green-edged mirror, I thought about them all and asked myself why those people made a difference. Why them? What is it about them? Such a disparate group, the richest and the most wretched, educated and illiterate, virtuous and criminal, old and young. It seemed that the only thing they had in common was a power to make me feel something. On the desk in front of me was a thick leather-bound book. I opened it and saw that it was Carla's journal, filled with entries in her own elegant handwriting. Knowing that I shouldn't, I turned through the pages and read her private thoughts. It wasn't a diary. There were no dates on any of the pages, and there were none of the day-to-day accounts of things done and people met. Instead, there were fragments. Some of them were culled from various novels and other texts, each one attributed to the respective author and annotated with her own comments and criticisms. There were many poems. Some had been copied out from selections and anthologies, and even newspapers, with the source and the poet's name written beneath. Other poems were her own, written out several times with a word or a phrase changed and a line added. Certain words and their dictionary meanings were listed throughout the journal and marked with asterisks, forming a running vocabulary of unusual and obscure words. And there were random stream-of-consciousness passages that described what she'd been thinking or feeling on a certain day. Other people were mentioned frequently, yet they were never identified except as he and she. On one page, there was a cryptic and disturbing reference to the name Shapna. It read, "The question, what will Shapna do?" "The answer, Shapna will kill us all." My heart began to beat faster as I read the words through several times. I didn't doubt she was talking about the same man, the Shapna whose followers had committed the gruesome murders Abdul Ghani and Majid had talked about, the Shapna who was hunted by the police and the underworld alike. And it seemed from that strange couplet that she knew something about him, perhaps even who he was. I wondered what it meant, and if she was in danger. I examined the pages before and after the entry more carefully, but I found nothing more that might concern him, or Carla's connection to him. On the second last page of the journal, however, there was one passage that clearly referred to me. "He wanted to tell me that he is in love with me. Why did I stop him? Am I so ashamed that it might be true?" The view from that place was incredible, amazing. We were so high that we looked down on the kites that flew so high above the children's heads. He said that I don't smile. I'm glad he said that. And I wonder why. Beneath that entry, she'd written the words, "I don't know what frightens me more, the power that crushes us, or our endless ability to endure it." I remembered the remark very well. I remembered her saying it after the slum huts had been smashed and dragged away. Like so many of the things she said, it had the kind of cleverness that insinuated itself into my memory. I was surprised and perhaps a little shocked to see that she too had remembered the phrase, and that she'd copied it down there, even improving it with more aphoristic roundness than the impromptu remark had possessed. "Is she planning to use those words again?" I asked myself. "With someone else?" The last page carried a poem that she'd written, her most recent addition to the almost completed journal. Because it appeared on the page following her reference to me, and because I was so hungry for it, I read the poem and told myself that it was mine. I let myself believe that it was meant for me, or that at least some part of it was born in feelings that were mine. I knew it wasn't true, but love seldom concerns itself with what we know or with what's true. "To make sure none followed where you led, I used my hair to cover our tracks. Sun set on the island of our bed. Night rose, eating echoes. And we were beached there, in tangles of flicker, candles whispering at our driftwood backs. Your eyes above me, afraid of the promises I might keep, regretting the truth we did say, less than the lie we didn't. I went in deep, I went in deep, to fight the past for you. Now we both know, sorrows are the seeds of loving. Now we both know I will live, and I will die for this love." Standing there, at the desk, I snatched up a pen and copied out the poem on a sheet of paper, with the stolen words folded secretly in my wallet. I closed the journal and replaced it exactly as I'd found it. I walked to the bookshelf. I wanted to study the titles for clues to the woman who'd chosen them and read them. The small library of four shelves was surprisingly eclectic. There were texts on Greek history, on philosophy and cosmology,